On the show today, a look at the job market, at car sales, and the impact student loans can have on our lives. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Portland, Oregon, I'm Rima Khreis in for Kai Rizdal, who's on assignment in China covering Secretary Yellen's visit. More from him tomorrow. It is Thursday, July 6th. Good to have you along. There are a lot of people waiting anxiously for tomorrow's June jobs report from the Labor Department. Economists, investors, my marketplace colleagues, and most importantly, of course, the Fed. The Fed wants to see job and wage growth cooling down, which would mean it's making inroads against inflation. Today, leading up to that much-anticipated jobs report, we got a lot of confounding, contradictory indicators. So we asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to figure out what is going on in the job market and the larger economy.
So here's what we learned today. Jobless claims are rising, according to the Labor Department, but announcements of job cuts by big employers actually fell by half last month, according to outplacement firm Challenger Gray & Christmas. The Labor Department reports job openings dropped by 500,000 in May, but more workers quit voluntarily in hopes of finding a better job fast. And private sector employers hired 500,000 new workers in June, according to payroll processor ADP, which is huge and totally confounds economists' expectations of a slowdown. Split all the differences, and economist Bill Adams at Comerica Bank comes up with this.
The job market does seem a little cooler than in 2022, although it's still good and it's adding jobs relatively quickly.
Adam says companies are seeing business slow down, but they worked hard to staff up in a labor shortage, so they don't want to lay anyone off now.
Because they think it might be really difficult to rehire if the economy picks up again.
Meaning the labor market is likely to remain challenging for employers.
Companies are growing, and there's more jobs than there are people.
Kathleen Quinn Votaw runs Talent First, a recruitment and retention firm.
Employees are quite optimistic and in the driver's seat. Just because a soft recession might be coming doesn't mean that the supply of workers is going to magically open up again.
She says boomers keep retiring and younger workers are more choosy about the jobs and locations and schedules they'll accept. Even though job growth has flatlined in manufacturing, some of those skilled workers can find jobs in construction, for instance, which is booming, says Jim McCoy at staffing firm Manpower Group.
Manufacturers need electricians. Home building industry needs electricians. Same thing with plumbers. Same thing with welders.
So bottom line for many workers, the good times are likely to keep rolling for a while. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
While we wait to get those job numbers from last month, one thing is for sure. Immigrants will keep playing a crucial role in this strong labor market. The share of foreign-born workers in the U.S. labor force is reaching near record highs. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
How are you doing today?
It's a bit after 5 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon, and things are getting busy for 46-year-old Tashika Wallace.
Did you want to do white wine or a red wine?
Wallace is assistant manager at Pacci's Trattoria, an Italian restaurant in the Washington suburb of Silver Spring, Maryland. Wallace is an immigrant. She came to the U.S. from Jamaica when she was 7. In fact, she says about a fifth of the workers here are immigrants. They take hard-to-fill jobs like cooks and dishwashers.
You got to work long hours. It's hot sometimes. You know, you deal with the tickets coming out, so many food orders. It's stressful.
Spiro Giodasis owns this restaurant and another in downtown Washington. He says immigrants used to make up just a sliver of his workforce.
5-10 years ago, it was probably 5%. Literally 5-8%. Very little.
But now he says it's closer to 20%. I asked Wallace and Giodasis what they would do without their immigrant dishwashers and cooks.
I don't know. I don't want to think about it because it's hard.
It would be hard to find someone.
The Labor Department says the share of foreign-born employees in the U.S. workforce grew from 17.4% in 2021 to about 18% last year. Brad Hirschbein, a senior economist at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, says the immigrant workforce is getting back to pre-pandemic levels and then some.
The share of immigrants in the workforce has actually reached a near record high And that's almost a couple percentage points above where it was during the pandemic.
Immigrants are helping make up for a shortage of native-born workers. Baby boomers are aging out of the workforce, and some people are still out because of the pandemic. There are almost two jobs for every job applicant, according to Harry Holzer, a professor of public policy at Georgetown University.
You need immigrants to make up that shortfall, especially when the demand for goods and services is so strong. So I think immigrants now are playing maybe a more critical role than 5, 10, 20 years ago.
And Holzer doesn't see that changing anytime soon as more boomers retire, shrinking the labor force even more and boosting demand for workers in some sectors like elder care. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, it is a down day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've talked a lot on this program about business inventories. Over the last year, people have been spending more on services and less on goods, which means businesses that sell those goods have found themselves with too much stuff. But that seems to be changing. We learned this week that inventory levels shrank in June. That's according to the Logistics Managers Index, which says that contraction was the second fastest in the history of the index. As Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, low inventory levels are starting to look like the new normal.
Early in the pandemic, Frankisha Watkins ordered a lot of extra product for her beauty supply store in the Dallas-Fort Worth area called Be Polished. Back then, she was worried she wouldn't have enough in stock. But this year, that's changed.
Honestly, I feel like we are at a good place.
Supply chains are working more smoothly, so now Watkins can focus on getting rid of items that aren't selling well, like wigs, for instance.
Some of those wigs are outdated or were in Texas, so it's extremely hot.
Watkins says she is stocking up on plenty of items that are selling, including hair gels, cosmetics, and perfume. But overall, she says her inventory levels are a lot leaner.
I've really been trying to focus on just-in-time inventory and not keeping a lot of back stock.
Keeping just enough product on the shelves, just in time for customers to buy it, is exactly how businesses managed their inventories before the pandemic.
But it does feel like we're having a return to normalcy.
That's Dale Rogers at Arizona State University, who helps put together the Logistics Managers Index. He says businesses want to keep their inventories as low as possible, in large part because holding on to items locks up a lot of cash. And
inventory doesn't always age well. It becomes obsolescence. You have the wrong stuff.
There are plenty of businesses where inventories are still too high. Jason Miller, a professor at Michigan State University, says that's especially true at the wholesale level.
Wholesaling of professional and commercial equipment and electrical goods and certainly apparel.
Miller says he expects those businesses to keep bringing down their inventories for at least another 6 to 9 months.
This is like turning a battleship, for lack of a better term.
In other words, Miller says inventories aren't going to balloon again anytime soon. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
The Supreme Court's decision to do away with President Biden's plan to forgive at least some student debt, that changes the financial picture for millions of borrowers. For the Marketplace podcast that I host, This Is Uncomfortable, I've interviewed a lot of people about the impact of their student loans, the feeling that their future was on hold until they could pay down this massive loan, the constant anxiety about making ends meet, and the lengths they went to move forward without debt. But some stories, they still surprise me because of the ways that one decision to take out student loans dramatically changed one person's life. Recently on This Is Uncomfortable, I talked with a woman named Kate Beaton. She's the artist behind the graphic memoir Ducks, which is about the job she worked to pay off her $40,000 in student loans.
To me, like, that was an astronomical sum. I could not imagine paying that much off.
This was back in 2005, just after Kate graduated college. Kate is from Canada, where student debt can be just as burdensome as it is here. As of last year, almost 2 million Canadians owed the federal government $23.5 billion in student loans. Kate had a dream of one day becoming an artist, but first she wanted to quickly get rid of that debt. She grew up in a really small town near Nova Scotia with very few job opportunities.
So there was like no question in your mind that you were going to leave.
No. You'd even go to the guidance counselor's office and they would be like, leave. And it just became very clear that I was going to go to the oil sands.
She'd go to work at the oil sands in Alberta, Canada, an isolated, desolate place. Might seem like an odd choice for a young artist like Kate, but that's where a lot of people in her hometown went, and for good reason. Oil jobs paid well. So Kate answered a newspaper ad for something called a tool crib attendant.
I went to an interview, and I lied to them and said that my father owned a hardware store, so I knew a lot about tools.
Did you know anything about tools?
No, I didn't know anything. And my dad is terrible with tools. Like, he's the one who's going around the house fixing things with tape.
She got the job. Kate would work long, grueling hours checking out tools to workers who were running the machinery on site. After a couple of weeks, she got her first paycheck.
I remember it being like $1,200. And I was like, I am rich.
It was more money than either of her parents had ever made in a single paycheck. But that increased financial security came at a cost to her safety. Just a heads up, from here the story contains some mentions of sexual violence. Back then, by some estimates, there was one woman for every 50 men in the oil sands. Kate faced constant harassment.
There wasn't a day without it. It became part of the background noise. And there are gradients of it. There is anything from people being in your face, saying things to you, touching you, getting too close. It took all forms.
Then Kate moved to the camps, housing set up for the workers. She didn't have to pay rent or groceries, no bills whatsoever. She could save nearly every dollar she made. The catch is that she lived in a long trailer with mostly men out in the middle of nowhere.
The first night that I was there, I slept without locking my door. And then I woke up in the morning and my door was wide open.
Oh, God.
Somebody had opened it and just left it open while I was sleeping.
Do you remember what you felt that morning?
Terror.
Kate started locking her door after that. But sometimes she'd wake up to the sound of the doorknob jiggling. A lot of her coworkers also came from small working class towns. They were working risky, difficult jobs in the oil sands to send money to their families back home. Many struggled with substance abuse. Despite everything, Kate felt solidarity with them. They could make an offhand sexist joke one moment and then be really sweet and genuine the next.
I'm generalizing immensely here, but so many men are raised to just ingest their own pain and never speak it, never complain, just work. And of course, it comes out somewhere. It comes out somewhere awful. And it doesn't excuse anybody's behavior. But you can't just say this place is full of monsters, because it is a place that is created by corporations to exploit workers, and it does its job.
After surviving multiple sexual assaults, Kate left the oil sands.
I felt I really, really needed to leave because I was clearly not doing okay. And that's very bittersweet, because it's almost like you know that you're going to go and waste your time somewhere because you still have to pay it off.
How much did you have left?
Half.
$20,000 sitting between her and her dreams. She took a huge pay cut and started working at a museum. But that meant her student loans were accumulating interest.
I couldn't have worked that hard and gone through all of that just to start piling up interest on the loan to get it back up to the point where it was just as much as it was before. That seemed to defeat the purpose of the whole thing.
Kate called the loan office and was like, please, can you give me some interest relief?
And they were like, no, but what happened to that other job that you had that was paying so good?
I should say, earlier this year, the Canadian government announced it's permanently providing interest-free loans for students. But back then, Kate felt like the oil sands were the only place that would pay her enough to quickly do away with her debt.
I needed to get rid of it, so I went back.
Then on June 6, 2008, 2 years after she'd started working there, Kate sat down at her desk to make her final payment.
And I was like, wow, it's done.
Years later, now that she's realized that dream of being a full-time artist, people ask her if her time in the oil sands was worth it.
I can only say that without having gone to the oil sands, I wouldn't be able to live the life I live now as a cartoonist, living at home. And so I benefited from my time there immensely. And I suffered from my time there as well.
She says, sure, there's a world in which she could have taken another route, found a job that would have allowed her to steadily pay off her debt over, well, who knows how many years. But she worries she would have gotten stuck that way, that the debt would have been a roadblock to achieving her dreams. If you want to read more about Kate Beaton's experiences in the oil sands, I highly recommend checking out her graphic memoir, Ducks. And if you just want more personal stories about money, you can check out the Marketplace show that I host called This Is Uncomfortable, wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up,
this model has failed and failed spectacularly.
Tell it like it is. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones fell 366 points, 1% to finish at 33,922. The Nasdaq dropped 112 points, 0.8% to close at 13,679. The S&P 500 dipped 35 points, 0.8% to end at 4411. We'll hear later from Stephanie Hughes about the state of car sales, but in the meantime, why don't we check in with some automakers? General Motors added 0.1%, Ford Motor Company slipped 2.4%, and Toyota is down 0.6%. Bonds fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.03%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. Yes, there are concerns about rising interest rates and inflationary pressures, but apparently for a lot of people, that is not enough to keep them from buying new cars. After a rough last couple of years, the auto industry seems to be bouncing back. Sales for new light vehicles, which is a category that includes cars, SUVs, and pickups, were up about 20% in June from this time a year ago. That's according to data from the research company Ward's Intelligence. Meanwhile, some individual car makers like Honda and Volvo, they saw increases double that. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes looks at what is fueling our desire for new cars.
A lot of people like to buy a new car on the regular, say every few years, says Michael Brown, an auto dealer with stores in and around New York City.
You own the car in the first 3 years of its life. Very unlikely they're going to have major repairs or anything like that.
But with supply chain shortages, people haven't been able to maintain that schedule. And now they're itching for a new model, even though prices remain elevated. Jessica Caldwell is with the car shopping and research site Edmunds.
The pent-up demand has been so high for so long, and consumers are just thinking, this is just how it is nowadays.
Lots of consumers also feel confident they'll have the money to buy vehicles they might have once considered unaffordable. T. Rowe Price chief economist Blarina Arucci says that's thanks to the strong labor market.
You have this idea in mind that when you need a job or when you need to work more hours in the week, you'll be able to do that because those jobs are available.
There's also demand from rental car agencies and even parks departments who want new pickups and weren't able to get a look in the past few years. One thing giving some buyers pause, though, the cost of auto loans. Again, car dealer Michael Brown.
Rates were so low for so long, people get used to that. So then when they see that interest rates come up and we actually have to pay interest on things, it's almost like getting punched in the nose.
And depending on what the Federal Reserve decides about interest rates later this month, those metaphorical punches might hurt even more. I'm Stephanie Hughes from Marketplace.
The UK's biggest water company is in deep trouble. Thames Water serves millions of customers in the British capital and the surrounding area. It was privatized more than 30 years ago, along with the rest of England's water industry. And today, the company is drowning in debt, blamed for pollution and water shortages. The government is mulling over whether or not to take the business back into public ownership. And while the company denies it is running out of cash, the reality is that it is under some serious public, political, and financial pressure. From the bank of the River Thames, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
It's raining heavily on a cold day in July, and two doughty female swimmers play joyfully in the river. Back on the riverbank, Joe Robb and Joan Finelli tell me they belong to a small local swimming club called the Henley Mermaids, and they'll swim whatever the weather.
You know, we've swum in the snow, we've had to sort of crack ice to get it to get to the water. Yeah, we'll swim in any weather. And every time we swim, we see something different. The river's different every time you come.
You see nature at its best, you know.
But sometimes, says Joe, they see human waste management at its worst.
We've seen sanitary products, we've seen sewage foam, sewage on the feathers of swans. We've seen it all, and it's very upsetting when you see it, because this is such a beautiful river.
The polluter is Thames Water, which, says Joe, who's a councillor, has failed to invest sufficiently in its sewage treatment plants that lie alongside the river.
Those are largely over capacity. They can't cope with the population, and so they're discharging untreated sewage into the river in winter, summer, all year round.
Thames Water has just been fined more than $4 million for sewage spills that killed thousands of fish. Meanwhile, its leaky pipes lose more than 100 million gallons of drinking water a day. The company rejected our request for an interview, but in a statement said it remains focused on delivering for its customers, the environment and stakeholders. It has certainly delivered for some of its shareholders. Since privatisation, the company has paid out almost $9 billion in dividends. Luke Murphy is with the Institute for Public Policy Research.
We've seen huge payouts in terms of dividends, but at the same time, we've also seen the inadequate investment in the infrastructure and then a failure to stop things like sewage spilling into our rivers. And now they're proposing that bills go up to pay the price.
Thames Water is reported to have pushed for a 20% increase in water bills. The regulator is thought to have rejected the demand, and that's what triggered the sudden departure of the company's CEO last month. Borrowing the money to upgrade its infrastructure is not an option. Thames Water is groaning under the weight of almost $18 billion of debt. Not a great advertisement for privatisation, says Murphy.
This model has failed, and failed spectacularly.
Thames Water is not listed on the stock market. Its private shareholders are pension and sovereign wealth funds, mostly foreign from Canada, China and Abu Dhabi. A previous shareholder, an Australian bank, extracted the most cash in dividends. But, says Oxford University professor Sadita Helm, don't blame the shareholders.
You know, if you sell your utilities to private companies, you expect them to profit maximise.
And he says Thames and the other privatised water companies have profited by borrowing heavily and not splashing out on infrastructure.
I don't blame the companies for pursuing profits. That's what private companies do. What I do blame is the regulators who failed to stop this happening.
Appearing before a parliamentary committee this week, the chief regulator, David Black, admitted that his body should have stopped the water companies from increased borrowing. For now, if the shareholders refuse to cough up the $3 billion that Thames is said to need, the utility may well wind up back in some form of public ownership. 15 million people in and around the capital can hardly do without water. From London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, for those of you who chronically forget things, or I don't know, maybe you just hate to pack, I saw on Bloomberg that Japan Airlines is starting a new initiative to offer rental clothing when you visit the country. It's going to be sourced from excess inventory to help reduce waste. One set of clothing can cost anywhere from about $30 to $50, which if you ask me, seems a little pricey. This service, though, comes at a time when the Japanese tourism industry is getting ready to welcome more visitors now that entry restrictions have been fully lifted and summer travel is in full swing. All right, we got to get out of here, but not before your moment of economic context. Started the show talking about jobs. Figured we could end there, too. I saw an article in Axios about how all the layoffs in tech have disproportionately impacted women. The industry skews male, yet women made up 45% of the layoffs over the last several months. One reason for that is because the layoffs, they were actually less techy than you might expect. We saw more layoffs in departments like HR and recruiting, which tend to have more women, than we did in departments like engineering and sales. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Rabawi is the managing editor. And I'm Rima Khreis. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.